pain's the same, and at the end of the day, we've all lost a child.
When you lose a child in a stigmatized death, such as fentanyl poisoning or suicide, you can feel the judgment of other parents. Celia Farmer was devastated by the suicide of her 14-year-old daughter, Molly. My family has a personal connection to Molly. My youngest son went to middle school with her, and this was the first person he knew who completed suicide during their freshman year of high school.
I got a call 10 minutes after I was at the grocery store that she had hung herself in her closet.
Celia was among the first moms to reach out to me as part of this club that no one wants to join, and we can never leave. I will always remember her kindness, and we had this insightful conversation about child loss and grief just a little more than a year after I lost Emily. Celia, let's start by talking about how you and I met. I met you shortly after Emily died, within weeks. You reached out to me as a mom who had lost her child a year earlier. Why did you do that?
I found that in my grief journey, that reaching out to other moms that have lost their children was very helpful to me. I like to think of myself as maybe a chain of support, where people that have lost their child, it's such an overwhelming experience, and you're in a blur. There's a fog, if you will, that takes over you. You know, when you lose your child, losing a child is probably the worst thing that can happen to anybody. It is the worst thing.
I think those of us who have lost children would agree to that. And now I know what you're talking about, because just recently, within the last couple of weeks, I know a mom who lost a son in a car accident. And I made sure to go to the visitation. As hard as it was for me, it was in the same funeral home where my daughter's visitation was held. So it brought up a lot of the trauma for me. But I made it a point to stand in the line and to hug her and to let her know that I was there for her. Because one thing that really stood out to me after Emily died were those who showed up. Where in the past, I might have just sent a card. I might have just, I didn't know this person super well. I might have just made a phone call later or done something along those lines. Now I know the importance of showing up. And you did that for me.
Right.
We didn't even know each other.
Nope. It's important to bring that presence to the families that have also suffered child loss. It's a hand up. It's a hand in the fog. And it just helps all of us that have lost a child know we're not alone.
Right. I think it helps me reaching out too, because then my pain can be useful.
Exactly.
I think that's the one thing you and I have both struggled with and strived to figure out. How can we take something that's so painful and seems so meaningless and create purpose and positivity from it?
Exactly. For me, positive points that I've learned from losing a child is, even as much as you don't want to get out of bed and you don't feel like going on, you have to remember that half of you, especially as a mother, half of you died the same day your child died. And it's really, really hard to get through that misery and the overwhelming pain and the fog. You just feel alone, even though you're surrounded by people.
The one thing I realized pretty early on, I think in this society of looking for relief, we look for relief from whatever pains and losses we're suffering from, big ones, minor ones, in the form of distraction, in the form of food or alcohol or something, right? To just relieve the brain from the horrible anxiety, the agony. And I found really pretty early on, I came to the realization that there was no magic pill. There was really no relief. Nobody could, even you, who'd been through this, and you wanted to meet with me, and we talked, and that was helpful to know I wasn't alone, but you couldn't offer me, oh, this is the magic thing you do to feel better.
There is nothing you can do to make yourself feel better, at least from a medication sort of standpoint.
Or even just like trying to, you know, distraction, it always comes mm-hmm. back. It's just such an overwhelming thing, right?
Right. You know, you go to work, you do that routine, you try to follow that routine. But there are times when even that routine can't save you. You just have to learn to pick yourself up and reach out to those people that you've built that support group with. For me personally, it's been the parents of kids that have lost their, or mothers and fathers that have lost their children. And it's not limited to just one thing. People that have lost their children have lost their children, whether it be through illness, accident.
Right. Sometimes, and you've probably experienced this too, I have people tell me, well, I lost a child. Oh, it was in a different way. Because there is so much shame surrounding mm-hmm. drug addiction and suicide. Mm-hmm. Both of these things have to do with mental health. And I always find that interesting when somebody says that. And I just kind of look at them and say, well, you lost a child. I lost a child. What does it matter?
Right. There
how
is
they
no
died.
Difference. There's no difference.
The pain is the same.
The pain's the same. At the end of the day, we've all lost a child.
And sometimes worse, there's so much guilt, I think, associated with the loss, whether it be to suicide or overdose, because you couldn't help them. And I heard a really great thing recently. Some researchers looking into grief would ask parents who were feeling a sense of guilt, did you ever do anything intentionally to harm your child?
Exactly.
Did you?
I never.
No.
Never did anything to harm my child.
Neither one of us ever did anything intentional.
And I believe most parents that are experiencing this would answer the same way.
Right.
I never did
anything. I think it's a universal answer. Mm-hmm. So the guilt really shouldn't be there, because we all did the best we could with the information we had at the time to try to help our children.
There's a big social stigma that's attached to losing a child in any respect. People would, at least I felt, people would look at me and think, oh, why did her daughter kill herself? She must be a horrible mother.
Do you think that's true, though? Or was that just, were those just negative thoughts in your mind?
I think part of it, a lot of it, is negative thoughts. And I think that the vision that you're seeing in front of you, even with your colleagues or your friends, they may seem like they've withdrawn. They're not thinking that. They just don't know what to say.
Let's talk about that for a minute. What to say. What do you think are some of the worst things that people can say to a grieving parent?
I have a whole list of them.
Well, rattle some off for me. Just a few.
Things like, she's in a better place.
Oh, that's one of my least favorite, because I want to say, how do you know that?
Yeah, they don't.
Can you prove that to me? I mean, I want to have faith. You're a faithful person, but mm-hmm. that's one of the worst things people can say.
It is awful.
For me, the other one, too, that I struggled with, especially at first, was just the simple, how are you? How are you doing? And I actually spoke to a counselor I've been working with to work through my grief, and she gave me a brilliant answer. I'm doing the best I can. So a lot of times I would say that. Now when people ask me, I just say, I'm okay. Because I never feel like I'm as happy as I was before Emily died.
Right. It leaves you with a hole in your body and in your mind where your child was.
What are some of those other things you were struggling a little bit to tell me? What some other things that people, the inappropriate things that people say that they don't even realize? You know, they're trying to be helpful. They're trying to be nice.
You'll get past this. Time heals all wounds.
Time will never heal this.
No, it doesn't.
I think it might, just from you're a year further along in this journey than I am, but just having a year have gone by, I don't think time can heal it, but it might dull the pain a little bit. Or
yes.
There might be more better days than worse days.
Absolutely.
Right.
I don't have as many crushing days where I just can't function. With the time that passes, you learn different ways to cope with that grief. It's never going to be something that's going to go away. I've found that having faith, that's played a huge role in trying to find a place where I could actually function as a productive member of my family or my work.
You know, Molly was a very faithful person as well. Church was important to her.
She was.
Let's talk a little bit about Molly, because I don't want that to get lost in this conversation surrounding her loss. Tell me who she was.
Molly was a wonderful kid. She was very bright. She was musically inclined. She played the violin since she was second grade.
Emily played the violin too since first or second grade.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of similarities between Emily and Molly.
Right.
Molly loved sports. She played softball. She ran track. She loved animals. There wasn't a time when this wonderful girl was not wanting to go to the Humane Society and walk the dogs or pet the cats, you know, and have some interaction of that sort. She brought every living creature into her home. Then I could count.
Well, bless you for allowing that. I don't know that I would have allowed that. Well, I'm allergic to a lot of things, but that's awesome that she, you know, you had that those experiences with her and those kind of joyful memories.
We do have a lot of joyful memories, and it's so important to remember those instead of focusing on the bad.
I think it's important to do both, don't you think? Mm-hmm. I think it's important to have balance because you don't want to think on one hand that everything was
peachy.
You don't want to gloss over it because it wasn't.
No.
I mean, I really struggled a lot with Emily and her behavior, especially starting about the age of 15, 16 and the rebellion that she was going through. And so I don't want to forget that any of that happened and just think about all the years before that where, you know, everything was great.
Right.
99.9% of the time. But I think it's also important to remember the joyful things that happened and the smiles and the hugs and the wonderful things as well as the struggles. To have a balanced idea in your brain.
Right. There does need to be a balance. One of the things I like to think about as far as Malls goes, you know, she was a teenager. And she didn't really get to the point of doing overt, naughty things that a teenager would do. She was very introverted. She liked her friends, but she didn't spend a whole lot of time with them. And maybe this should have been an indicator for her father and I, but we didn't see it. She had always loved being at home with her family.
Well, I have a child like that too, who just likes to be at home.
Right.
And is more introverted.
Right.
So there are introverts and there are extroverts. I don't know that that's necessarily a sign that someone will die by suicide.
Exactly. She was such an artistic person as well. She painted. She did a lot of crafts. She enjoyed doing things on the computer, visual artwork. There's so many things that you could, as a parent, go on and on and on about how great your kid was. And you know, everybody knows teenagers are not fun to be with sometimes.
They can be challenging, for sure, and especially strong-willed ones.
Mm-hmm.
At what point did you know that something was wrong?
She came to us about 3 weeks before she passed away, before she completed suicide. It was pretty late. It was a Sunday. And she came into my room at about 11 p.m. and she was in tears, and I didn't understand why she was so upset, and she wouldn't talk to me. She handed me a post-it note, and I read it, and it said, "I want to die." So immediately I had her get dressed, and we took her down to Avera's Behavioral Health, and they admitted her. So she spent about 8 days there.
And this is just 3 weeks before she died, the first sign of a very serious problem.
3 weeks. The psychiatrist recommended that she take Prozac. So they started her on the smallest dose. I can't say that it was working or not. Those types of medications
take
weeks
time.
And months to work. She went to counseling. She went to peer counseling. We did everything that we thought was appropriate in her case.
I'm sure you did.
We brought her home. She had trouble with school. I think she was ashamed, and she just didn't want to see anybody. And she talked about online school.
Because people knew she'd been hospitalized? Did they know? Is that what she was ashamed of?
She was ashamed that everybody knew that she had been hospitalized for mental illness. So there again, we go back to that stigma, which doesn't start with the parents. It actually starts with your child. It's that social stigma that makes mental illness not okay in our society.
So she came home, and she's talking about, maybe I need to go to school online. She was a little bit embarrassed to go back to school. But she did go back to school.
She went back to school for about 3 days. And that Friday, unbeknownst to us, she had cleaned out her locker. Of course, we wouldn't know that, you know, because we don't.
So she, in her mind, was thinking this out.
Right. She didn't do things like give her stuff away. She didn't say goodbye. She just packed out her locker and One of the funny things, she had a very, very good friend. She wasn't able to meet her face to face. They spent a lot of time chatting, and they were the same age. And that Friday, her friend came to Sioux Falls for a gymnastics tournament. So Molly asked if she could meet her, and we all went as a family and met her family, and they were just thrilled to see each other. That morning, she just didn't seem herself. And we had gone to Scheels to buy her sandals for the spring. It's a mom and daughter thing.
Yeah, shopping always.
Shopping.
Yeah.
She had a meltdown. And so I took her out to the car and we chatted and talked, and I told her that everything would be okay in time. Lean back on that faith. Lean back on your family.
Seems like sound advice.
She continued to say, "I'm such a burden. I'm useless." Things like that. And at that point, I started to worry that there was more going on there. I did talk to her doctor. I called the on-call number, got a hold of her psychiatrist, and she said to just keep an eye on Molly, and she would see her on Monday. And I think that's a natural thing. That's a pretty good response for something we don't know about.
Right.
That afternoon, I asked her if she wanted to come to the grocery store with me, another Saturday routine for us. And she didn't want to go. So I just took it as she just needs to rest.
Of course. Who wouldn't?
Right. She was just in a tough place. I got a call 10 minutes after I was at the grocery store that she had hung herself in her closet.
10 minutes.
10 minutes after I left.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I must have driven 90 miles an hour down Marion. I ran every light. I got there and the fire rescue team was already there. The front of my home, there were so many police officers.
Isn't that just burned? When you talk about it, you relive it, don't you? Because I know I do when I start talking about that scene and arriving at the scene and the emergency personnel. And
it'll never leave.
It's so traumatic.
It's traumatic and it's burned. It's burned right into your soul and into your heart and your mind. I never got to say goodbye to my daughter. We looked for a letter or a note. We didn't find one right away. She left a note, and it was, my daughter was a little pack rat. And when her older siblings had moved out of the home, she would just rotate from room to room.
So she would just claim another room and then put her stuff in there. Yep. Yeah.
So, you know, by the end, she had 3 bedrooms.
Oh, that's funny.
And when cleaning out all those bedrooms, we found the note in one of the beds in not her main bedroom. So that was very hard for us.
You can share with us if you want what it said. You don't have to. But did it shed any light? Did it answer any of your questions?
It did not. All of her note said was how much she loved her dad and I.
Well, she loved you. And she wanted you to know she loved you.
And that she felt like a failure at everything she had done. You know, this was a B-plus student. She excelled at everything.
She wasn't a failure. Even if she didn't get good grades, you know, as a kid, you're not a failure. Yeah.
No, it's a learning
experience.
But
she saw herself as that.
Exactly.
And that's something wrong with the brain wiring, right?
Absolutely. I
mean, it goes along with that mental illness and depression.
That mental illness, the depression, the anxiety that she was feeling.
Let's talk about the things that people should say. We talked about what people shouldn't say. What should they say?
Just presence. Just to hear her name.
People are afraid
to use the name.
Mm-hmm. Or just even bring it up or talk to you about it.
It's hurtful because our daughters were here. They were people. They had lives. And
they were more, the thing that bothers me, I think, and I'm sure it bothers you too, they were more than just how they died.
Exactly.
Were the illness they were suffering from. In Molly's case, mental illness, and Emily's case, mental illness combined with addiction, because I think the two always go hand in hand.
Absolutely.
And so as people, as souls, they were much more than that.
Their death should not define them.
And that's hard in our society.
It is. I think that's the social norm. If somebody does drugs, they're a bad person. If somebody completes suicide, oh, there must have been a problem in the family. You know, and that's not the case. It really isn't. You can have a child that has mental illness and or drug addiction on top of that, or anxiety, or any other of the mental illnesses that are fairly common amongst children in the United States.
Extremely common today.
And it's not something that our children should be blamed for or looked down upon for. It's like having cancer. If any one of our children had cancer, there would be so much support rallied around them. And when your child dies of suicide or an overdose or something that's not a societal norm, then people, I think, pull back. They just don't know what to say.
I'm hoping with conversations like this one that we can change that eventually. It may take some time, but eventually I hope for other parents who face this kind of thing in the future, that will go away because of moms like us who are willing to talk about it.
I think you have to get out on the forefront. That's one of the biggest things that have really helped me manage my pain.
Yeah, let's talk about that. How have you done that? How have you gotten out onto the forefront and helped manage your pain? And I know it's not always easy.
Right. I've actually gone to the Capitol pier, and I'm currently working with Senator Wayne Steinhauser. We've explored a lot of options and opportunities as far as what can we do as a state to try to open up that line of communication about stigma and mental illness. Currently, he's working on education, which is a great first start. And not so much education for children that are suffering from mental illness or addiction, more for our first responders. They're the front line. They're the ones who have to walk in and see these things. And it's not pleasant. As we know, most of our firemen, they have families.
And I think they suffer from post-traumatic stress, too.
They suffer terribly. And, you know, our law enforcement, you know, these people that are on the scene, it's so difficult for them. One of the things we did, my husband and I, after Molly died, about 6 months later, we went out to the fire station to speak with the firefighters that were actually on the scene trying to save Molly. And for them, I think it was really relieving to know that the child that they couldn't save was a child. She was a real person. We brought pictures of her. We answered any questions that they may have had in regards to Molly. And most of the stuff they were interested in was who she was.
That's wonderful. That's,
it is.
It's really great that you did that and really great that they wanted to know.
They did. And it was a huge relief. And, you know, it wasn't just the firefighters there. We had some police officers show up that were on the scene that day, paramedics.
You know, one of the things I think that's hardest about losing someone so important in your life, and such a huge, huge loss, is that life doesn't stop after this loss.
It doesn't.
And the stresses of life don't end. In fact, they can often be intensified. Have you found that to be the case?
They do get worse. I know for myself personally, I've struggled with work. I've had a career for 16 years trying to reincorporate yourself into your work family. That can be very, very difficult.
Why is that, do you think?
Again, I think it goes back to people don't know what to say.
And people are also uncomfortable. They don't want to have to think about it because most people think this can never happen to them.
Right.
You and I know it can happen to anybody at any time for lots of different reasons.
Right.
But people don't want to be reminded of that either.
No, they don't. And, you know, it's one of those things where you just can't hold a grudge against them. You just have to try to muddle your way through it. And sometimes that just doesn't work. And you find that the things in your life that were important before
Yes.
And that's so important.
Yes. I think that your priorities change. First of all, you realize that the rug can be pulled out from under you at any moment. And I don't think any of us believed that before this happened to us.
No.
And so things that seem so important before this life-changing event, you now know really aren't. And your priorities do shift.
They do, absolutely. I've found myself being drawn more to helping and service to others.
And I think that is a healing thing for both of us, in helping other people. Then you don't think about yourself and your own pain as much by putting yourself out there to help others.
Even with Emily's hope, I'm just amazed. I couldn't have done that within the first year.
Well, thank you. I think I felt an obligation because of the platform that I have.
Right.
And it has also been very healing for me. It's been a place for me to channel my grief. Now, there are some downsides to some of that, too. But overall, for the most part, I'm really glad I did it.
I believe that that has reached so many people in our city.
I always say if I can just save one person, and I'm sure you feel the same way.
Absolutely.
And you've spoken to groups and...
I've spoken to groups. I've worked with individual families that have children that are at risk.
So you've saved lives already.
I would like to think that.
I would like to think it too. Yeah.
As far as Malls goes, we did set up a scholarship for her.
Oh, nice.
At O'Gorman. So children who want to attend Catholic faith-based schools can have an opportunity to attend, and with this scholarship, it supplements that tuition fee.
That's great.
But that's about all we did. I just found that even though I like the idea of her scholarship, it's much better to have boots on the ground, remembering her that way.
Let's talk about your faith for a minute. I'll be honest with you and tell you that I have always been, I'm Catholic as well. We're both Catholic. Catholic school, born and raised Catholic. Raised my children, you know, and I also, one of the things I struggle with a little bit is raise your children up in the way they should go, right? So
right.
You take them to church, you have them go through their first communion and their, all everything, all of the sacraments and confirmed in Emily's case. And this still happens.
It does.
It's like it shouldn't happen if you're following all the rules set out by the church, right?
Exactly.
And so I've struggled a little bit with that. And it's not that I am a spiritual person, and I do believe there is a God, an intelligence in the universe. But it's been hard for me. When I go to church, I cry. I mean, also, that's where her funeral was held. And so it's been really hard, and I think we're all expected to sort of just pick up where we left off.
Faith, myself being a cradle Catholic, we're expected to follow our catechism, participate in our services, observe our holy days. The first year after we lost Molly, I couldn't even walk into my parish. Of course, that's where her funeral was held. Her classmates all attend Mass there, or at least a great part of them do. So I knew the kids that were Molly's age and their families, and Molly and I did quite a bit with the church. She was a server during Mass.
Has your faith increased since all this has happened?
I think it's starting to rebud is probably a better way to put that.
And why is that?
You have an anger, and I don't think it's necessarily with your parish. It's anger with God, because we don't know. We don't know why this happened. And if there was a God, why didn't he stop this?
Why was it allowed to happen, right?
Absolutely. For me, I'm not typically an angry person. And I never did go through that phase with Molly yet of being angry with her.
I haven't been angry at Emily either.
Yeah, it's weird. But I don't think you have to go through all those steps.
I think they've kind of proven that those five stages of grief are not very accurate.
No, they're not. And they don't all happen in the same order.
No.
But I was never angry with Molly. I was angry with God. He took my best friend away. He took my youngest child. It's having your heart and your soul ripped out at the same time. and not knowing it was coming. And again, we followed the rules. We did everything that our faith prescribed for us to do. And once again, there are people out there that suffer this tragedy as well. It's hard to explain. But faith for me in this second year of Molly's absence is something that I've really had to work to build on. And faith wouldn't be my primary source of comfort. It wasn't for a long time. Year and a half, I just went through the motions.
Right.
Especially this last year. I'd show up to church, I'd go through the motions, I would leave. And I didn't feel like I was really getting anything out of it like I used to.
Right.
But now there's kind of a glimmer there, trying to rebuild my relationship with God. And hopefully, you know, that'll be a good stepping point and crutch for me to fall back on.
What has been the most helpful to you through all of this?
Meeting people that have gone through the same thing I have, like meeting you. Most of the people that I was friends with, or I thought were my friends, have disappeared.
Right. So, I hear that a lot. And have even noticed a few people I thought were friends have a lot less to do with me now.
Absolutely. And it's hard. That hurts.
It does hurt. It's another loss. It's a loss on top of a loss. It's maybe more minor loss, but it's a loss on top of a loss.
And loss over loss over loss, it can really bring a person to their knees.
Mm-hmm.
I've found that my support circle now are women and husbands of these women, fathers, who've lost their children, have become my primary support.
What brings you joy today?
Seeing my granddaughter, my grandchildren.
Yes, I bet. Children will do that, right?
They do. And I think with their presence, for a long time, I just didn't want to see any of them.
Why was that?
It was a reminder.
Just too painful.
Right.
That your child is gone and here's another child, but it's not to replace. Your grandchild can't replace your child.
No, they can't. And I just didn't want to be around any children. And in meeting folks like you and my friends out in the city that have lost their children, it's given me some reinforcement to tell me, you know, it's okay to stand up on your two feet. It's okay to be sad. It's okay to have good days.
Yeah, I think you're touching on something there. I think that sometimes we feel guilty when we're happy in the moment or when we're laughing,
right,
because the overwhelming grief and sadness seems to surround us all the time. But occasionally when that lightens up or lets up, then you'll feel almost as if you're betraying
your
child who has died.
That is exactly how it feels like. I think those feelings start to spread out over time.
And that's where I'm talking about time dulls it maybe a little bit.
It dulls it.
Eases it a little. Mm-hmm. It doesn't ever take it away.
No.
And I don't think you'll ever get over losing a child.
No, there's no getting over that. It just changes. A gal that I had met whose daughter completed suicide about 5 years before Molly did, when I asked her in my first year, how am I going to get through this? How am I going to live? She just told me, I can't say that it's going to get better or that it's going to magically fix itself. It evolves into a different way of living.
I had a friend, actually a new friend, so someone I met after Emily died, reach out to me, and she had lost her daughter more than a decade earlier. And her daughter was 13. And she said, life becomes richer and more joyful in certain ways, which I just looked at her at the time and I was like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, are you crazy?
Right. But I think that has to do with the changing of priorities, too.
Absolutely.
Because you realize what's really important, and when you focus on that, there can be joy in that.
There is. I have worked so hard to be successful at what I do. I spent that time focusing solely on that, mm-hmm. not with the intent of ignoring my family, but wanting to make their lives better.
Right. Well, we mothers who work outside the home do so to support our families and to help our families. And we want to be successful at that so that we can better support our families.
If I could choose now, I know honestly in my heart, money and things don't matter as much as I thought they did.
Right. It's just the moments that we have.
I should have spent more of the time being a mother with my children instead of trying to climb that corporate ladder. So today, that's a big lesson that I've learned, and trying to be joyful in the moment, because they do happen, and they sneak up on you, and you find yourself smiling or
laughing.
Oh my
gosh, I'm happy. How can that be?
Right.
Right.
Because it changes you. It makes you into somebody that you never thought you could be.
Do you know what else I found for myself that is very true? I am much more compassionate and much less judgmental.
Absolutely.
Of people and of families and of situations. I feel like I have such insight and understanding, especially in my case, when it comes to addiction. When I meet people who are struggling with addiction right now, I see them as a whole person. I see them as somebody's child.
Nobody chooses addiction either. It's a mental illness.
And do you think you have more compassion for...
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you become a more compassionate person. But at the same time, you have to kind of... I always liken it... I read this quote. I can't remember exactly where I got it from, but it's like the brick in the pocket. Like you're walking around with the brick in your pocket, and sometimes you can forget that brick is there. But every once in a while, you stick your hand in your pocket. Oh, yeah, there's that brick. You kind of get used to carrying that heavy weight of the brick. So you get used to carrying the heavy weight of grief.
That's the truth.
And every once in a while you forget it's there, and there it is again.
I kind of like to think of that as my backpack with stones in it.
Right.
And along the way, through the process of grieving and trying to find my new normal, I'm able to take one of those rocks out of my bag and set them to the side.
Right. And no two people grieve alike. I mean, some people are more resilient. I think a lot of it depends on your background, your history, your brain. I mean, so many things. And so even when we're connecting as parents with other parents who've lost children, that we can be grieving in very different ways.
Absolutely. The grief process is different for everyone. There are folks that are very, very strong. And they appear to be very strong is probably a better
People
word.
Always tell me I'm strong, and I find that. I talked to another man who said the same thing, who lost his daughter to overdose. Do people tell you you're strong all the time because you talk about it? And I said, yes, but I don't think that's the right word. I don't feel strong. I just feel like I'm capable of doing this, so I do it.
That's one of the things I admire about you, Angela.
Celia.
When
thank
I met you.
You,
and it wasn't even very long after Emily passed. The one thing that struck me was you were very driven.
I'm a very driven person. I think that's just my personality.
Right. You were driven to put that big sign up, where a lot of us can't do that, either because we're afraid or we don't know how to. But to put that sign up for mental illness and a drug addiction and all the things that society tends to shun or look away from, And put that message out there so loudly and with such grace, it's a benefit to all of our parents who've lost a child.
I do feel like I'm shouting from the rooftop sometimes. You know, this is addiction. This is a disease. This is mental illness. You know, we need to have more compassion. We need to have better treatment. All of these things. I also sometimes feel the struggle of I'm only one voice and I can only do so much. And so it takes everybody. And you are speaking to me in this podcast. That's brave, Celia. A lot of parents wouldn't do that. So the fact that you're joining me in this fight means so much to me because I couldn't, and other mothers, other parents, and other people, I couldn't do it alone. There's no way.
There has to be a voice. And as long as we see that beacon in one, it's a light, and it will draw other people to that beacon who've experienced the same pain and sorrow we have, and we just keep adding those voices one by one, and pretty soon we're an orchestra.
I love that analogy. That's awesome. I was recently in Washington, D.C. at an addiction policy forum meeting, and they include families who've lost loved ones in the opioid epidemic as part of this group where we're stakeholders in this organization. And so I was with about 30 other parents who'd all lost children. And it is interesting immediately. I mean, there's no judgment among any of us. We're not sizing each other up. We're not looking at what the other parents, other woman is wearing or any of these things. It's just, it's instant acceptance and it's instant empathy and compassion. And you just know that person. You know what they've been through. Now, you may respond in different ways and things like that, but that's not what I'm talking about. But it was really interesting. This group of mothers, we were sitting around, and then all of a sudden the subject of, have you had a sign from your child? And this subject came up, and every single mother had more than one sign, several signs from their children. And I just found that to be such a fascinating conversation that you couldn't have with anybody else.
No, they would think
you're crazy.
You're quite mad, off your rocker.
Some of these things were mind-blowing, though, so I have to say, I won't tell other people's stories, but without them here, but some of them were really mind-blowing. Some of the signs I have received, I think, oh, do I just want that to be a sign? Is that just a coincidence? But I had someone tell me, if you find comfort in it, what does it hurt?
It doesn't. It doesn't hurt anything.
I know you've been through counseling, grief counseling, and what have you learned from all that?
I am still doing grief counseling.
Well, good. So everyone, I think this is a journey. It's a process. It doesn't happen overnight.
And it's a process.
What have you learned, though, do you think?
Probably learning to love myself more than anything.
We put our children first, don't we?
We do.
I feel like I love my children more than I love myself. And I know that you're not supposed to, right? You're supposed to love yourself first.
Right. And
but we're all moms, you know.
We do this because of that love, the connection we have with our children, carrying them in our womb, giving birth to them. Not that the dads are off to the side, but that connection to our children in that manner as a woman is very, very deep because we do produce them with our body. I think with therapy, self-acceptance, trying to learn to love yourself, having somebody listen to you that's not going to judge you.
Non-judgmental listening, right?
Right, right. I actually went through, I like to call it the interview process. I interviewed several therapists before I settled with the one that I am working with. There's not a right fit if you choose to go the therapy route. You have to really shop for who you want to work with. And that can be frustrating for a lot of parents, especially parents that don't have the means to seek out that type of treatment.
Well, and everything, there's so many demands on this. It's also time consuming. You have to leave work. I mean, because these therapists work normal business hours, right?
Right, right.
So you have to leave work. You have to find this person. You have to somehow incorporate it into your schedule, which there's a lot of demands on all of us.
Right.
But it's so important that we don't neglect
ourselves. And I've come to the point where if I can't take care of myself in that manner, I'm useless to everybody else. I'm useless to my other children who, yeah, they're grown, they're old, they're
they always need
own.
You, though.
They still need you. And I can't be of service to them or anybody else unless I'm taking care of me, and which is a hard lesson to learn because I never did that before.
We're trained as women and as moms in this society, put others first. But as the analogy goes, you have to put your own oxygen mask on first before you can help put on others.
Right, right. It's a good analogy for that. I've just found that if I can't take care of myself, then everything else has to take second seat.
And you have made you're doing some new things in your life that are exciting, something to look forward to, right?
They are. I'm just thrilled. I was accepted at Dakota State University.
Congratulations.
I'm going to do something that I love instead of doing something that I have to do to make that income. And even though I've had a very successful career, I need a change. And I felt this need to, I guess you would call it cleaning house.
And you moved too. I mean, you've done you've made a lot of big changes.
Big changes. I waited a year and sort of spent that last 6 months of the year really taking inventory of the things that were important in my life and the things that were not so important. And I decided that I needed to have a makeover.
Yeah, and you're doing it. You're doing it every day. And I know there are lots of hard days, but just the fact that you're putting one foot in front of the other and making these decisions and doing something new and learning something new.
Right.
It's really good for you.
It is, and it's positive. And those are the things that, even though my heart is broken, it will never become unbroken. I can do things that I never thought I could do.
So it seems almost sacrilegious to say that something positive comes out of such horrible tragedy. But I think it's all kind of how we look at it and frame it up. Not to negate the loss and not to say that their lives didn't matter, or you're happy that something happened to your child because these positive things resulted from it. But there are, if you choose to find them and look at it, there are positive things that come out of even the worst tragedies. Look at Auschwitz. Look at some of the people that came out of concentration camps and what they were able to do with their lives.
If you make a choice to change, to look at the positives, to feel joy and not feel guilty about it, put that angst that people that have lost their children into motion, you could build so much. Kind of like to think of it as a moth or a butterfly. You end up in a cocoon, you don't know how to get out, you're very immature. And as time goes on, a beautiful butterfly can emerge from that, and you don't have to stay in that cocoon.
Right, and that's the healthy thing to do, because some people do choose to stay stuck.
Stuck is absolutely right. And when you're in that dark space, nothing good can come out of it. And I don't want to sound insensitive to my club members in this awful club we're in. That nobody had a choice.
Nobody wants to join. Yeah, welcome to the club. Ugh.
They just, I wish for a moment that all of us who are suffering from this loss, just take a minute and look at yourselves and know that you're not alone. But reaching out or being the one to reach your hand out is something that, if you want to take that first step, that should be it right there.
And I think if you can open your heart instead of closing your heart through whatever tragedy or loss you've experienced in your life. There's a lot of losses, divorce, other things, losing a job. If you can, instead of shutting down and closing off your heart, if you can open your heart, that's when you'll find new paths and you'll find joy again.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate you opening up and sharing Molly's story with us and talking about it and also keeping her memory alive and for helping other parents. That's huge.
I just want to be of service.
I love that. And we'll end on that note. Thank you.
Thanks, Angela.
You can listen to more episodes of Grieving Out Loud and read my blogs on our website, emilyshope.charity. If you like what you're hearing, please consider leaving us a positive review on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening. Until next time, wishing you faith, hope, and courage.